This is Hazel Khan, bringing you tidings from a Rasta family yard in Oracabessa on the north coast of Jamaica. I'm going to be introducing you to two of their resident artists. The first is Ronnie Carson, who'll talk about her art. Later on the program, Russ Ibrock will tell us about Rastafari. In addition to her studio here in Jamaica, Ronnie also has a studio in Riverhead, New York. I'm very happy to welcome you to Tidings, Ronnie, and I'm looking forward to what you're going to tell our listeners about Rastafari, but also about how you came to be here and about the path that your art has taken. So welcome, Ronnie. Welcome.
Give thanks. Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
So would you start by telling us a little bit about, in fact, how you did come here, where you know, what is your path to be sitting in this wonderful garden in Jamaica? How did it all start? Where were you born? I mean, people like to know that.
I was born in the Bronx, actually, and my family lived in Washington Heights. And I grew up in Washington Heights. Oh, yes, my family was Jewish. Not very observant Jewish, but Jewish.
Yeah.
There was never any real religious experience in my family. It was more observant, outer kind of Jewish
rituals.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, I wanted to be a writer in college. I was an English major, but I never really had any success with that. A year or so after I graduated from college, I met a wonderful artist, Herman Rose, and his wife. And I loved Herman's work. It was really very sensitive and very beautiful work, and I was very entranced by it. And I went on a trip to Puerto Rico maybe weeks or months later after I met him, and I started painting watercolors there. And when I got back to New York, I showed them to him, and he said they were illustrative, which was not a good word for him. And I started to study with him. I studied with him at the New School, and I went out painting trips with him sometimes, and I learned a lot about painting from Herman and everything I know about color. It was a kind of friendship, tutelage, and also formal in school. Mm-hmm. After that, I went to Europe for several years. I lived in Paris, and I studied paintings in the Louvre and in Jeu de Paume. And I went to other museums in Europe and really soaked in as much art as I could and was painting full-time for the first time. Mm-hmm. I saved some money in New York, so.
And then what happened?
Well, then I went to Brooklyn College, got my master's, and started to teach. But in 1980, my life changed because the man I was living with, his name was Eddie Earle Cato, and he was a wonderful landscape painter and an extraordinary person. He was killed in an automobile accident when we were visiting his family in Arkansas. And for the years after that, I was kind of sleepwalking through my life. Sometime after that, I had a sabbatical from school. I went on a trip to Jamaica, and one of the people in the group that I was with had a breakdown. He was bipolar, and he just totally went out of control. And the group was gone. I was just me and my roommate. And we appealed to two Rastas we had met down the road. They had a little roadside stand. Mm-hmm. And we went up there and asked them to help us. And they did, and they took care of him until help came. The way they handled him, they were so compassionate. They were so wise. They were so strong. They had so much humor. They quoted the Bible all the time with great intelligence and wisdom. I was very impressed with them. And I began to get to know them, and I went back to Jamaica on another trip, stayed with the family of one of them. And the third trip, I stayed with one of the Rastas and his family, and just got to know more and more about Rasta and to see what it really was about. And for me, it provided the kind of meaning that had gone out of my life when Ed died. Before the accident, actually, I was painting traditional subjects like still life portraits, landscape. I always loved portraits. But just before the accident, maybe 2 years, I found a doll museum in Greenport, Long Island. And when I walked in, I saw this amazing imagery of these Victorian dolls that looked like they were straight out of Dickens or Jane Austen or Bronte or all the books that I loved. So I started to paint Victorian dolls.
When most people think of Rasta, they think of ganja, dreadlocks, Bob Marley, and red, yellow, the colors, red,
yes,
yellow, and green,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So what you're saying is something that is not compatible with what most people say.
There's more to it than people realize. Rasta represents a lot of things. Many families who are aspiring to better things don't want their children to be Rasta, because Rasta is not the upward spiral toward riches and security.
Even the Rasta is actually the upward spiral in self.
In self-development, yes, but not in terms of the world.
So Rastas are poor, they're unemployed? I mean, what is it?
They don't want to be employed in the system. They're not interested in that. They want to stay close to nature. They farm. You know, they do their artwork sometimes. They will sell different items sometimes. But they don't really join the system. Although there are Rasta artists. I mean, Rasta artists, yes. Rasta doctors, Rasta lawyers, but not many. Some Rastas don't smoke ganja. It's not always ganja, even though ganja is a plant. And I don't think it should be criminalized, but and should never have been criminalized. But as far as Bob Marley, Bob Marley's message was truth and rights and justice.
One love.
One love, exactly.
You know as well as I, better than I do, how people's image of Rasta is based on these symbols, these visual symbols of the colors
yeah,
and the
well,
hair. And
the dreadlocks are really what, they're not really a style, even though many people do it for a style. But dreadlocks are really a covenant with the Creator to live up to the highest one is capable of.
How does that translate into letting your hair grow?
Well, it's just letting your hair grow naturally, the way the Creator made it, rather than trying to fix it up and be somebody you're not, or trying to make an image for yourself. It's the way you are. And dreadlocks do express the person. For example, if you look at somebody from the back, and I've painted many Rastas from the back, and painted their dreadlocks, it's just as much a portrait of them. It's their faces almost, you know, it's almost as much, because there's no artifice. I don't know all the hair care stuff. When I did it, I just put aloe on my hair and my locks came.
Because yours are really long, right? They're almost down to the ground.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was from 1989.
I don't want this whole thing to be about dreadlocks and hair, because that's not really what we're supposed to be talking about.
Right.
But we'll talk about your art in a minute. But
yeah.
But do you, I mean, I'm just fascinated by dreadlocks, and you are too. I mean, I can see from your work. When I was looking at the work that you have here in Jamaica, is there all these portraits? And many of them are side portraits.
Mm.
And there's great emphasis on the locks. But it's clear that you're very intrigued as say I am, but for different reasons maybe, by the locks. I mean, and so a lot of them are from the back or from the side. There's fewer portraits that I've seen, and you can correct me, maybe I've just seen a limited amount of your work, that are from the front,
yeah,
the way portraits usually are.
Yeah, but I do have some, like the ones I'm starting right now are two frontal. Did you see them?
Yeah.
And then my last show, I had quite a few frontal pictures of Rasta, so one of the reasons that I haven't done some frontal views is because I love to catch people when they're not being photographed and they're not knowing that they're photographed. I have permission, because they're my friends, to do that. But when I came to Jamaica, nobody had time to sit and pose for me. And also with some of those paintings, I was really thinking of Renaissance French portraits. I was thinking of the composition of the head and the space.
So then your painting just started to become more and more of Rasta subjects?
I like to paint what inspires me. And there have been discussions and times when we are having talks that are very spiritually inspiring. And those are the moments that I want to capture. I'm trying to capture spirit, actually, in physical form. Capture the highest and best meditations that humans are capable of in physical form. I'm trying to visually depict that. I don't always succeed, but I mean, that's what I try. That's what inspires me.
Now I'm looking at a portrait that inspired you in this way. What would you want me to be seeing?
People, unfortunately, don't know enough about Rasta to recognize that a Rasta person does symbolize all the things that it does, that Rasta symbolizes for me. So I'm painting people who are involved in a lifestyle that I totally believe in and respect.
And accept and live.
Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that the viewer will see that.
Rani Carson is talking about her life and work as a Rasta artist in Jamaica and the United States. Later on in the program, Russ Ibrock will be talking about Rastafari. This is Tidings on WPKN Radio. Now, anybody who knows you or sees you or sees you walking around, these are the things they know about. That you're Rasta, that you're a woman, that you're white as opposed to black. If they see you in the studio, if they talk to you for 2 minutes, they know you're an artist. So I'm just wondering if you could talk about these four dimensions of yourself and how they come together or sometimes don't come together, or, you know, is it a smooth blending? Is it difficult to be a white woman Rasta artist ever? Or do you just hate the fourth thought that I'm even calling you that?
I don't love being called white. When I am asked the question on a form, what race, I always say other. I always check off other. I feel affinity to all races. I don't feel separation. I don't like these labels. And
I understand that that's what you want to be, but I'm just wondering, living here in Jamaica, which you do much or most of the time, is that how you are seen? I mean, you may want to be other, but are you in fact seen as other in the other sense, as, right? You don't want to be classified, but other people see you as other.
Yes.
They're not like them,
which are two
meanings of other.
That's
and I'm really
true.
Curious about that. So that white thing, I mean,
yeah,
you've resolved it, but I'm not, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm just really curious how that is for you and whether it's created any problems. Usually people have problems not being white rather than being white, and you've resolved it partly. But just being white is, you're not really white, you're kind of Sephardic or you're, you know, I mean, whatever. I mean, I think of myself as white, and I'm probably pretty much the same color as you are, same color, kind of tones.
Oh, I'm a little darker.
Yeah, because you've been sitting in the Jamaican sun. You'd like to be darker, maybe. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd like to be darker, but for different reasons. I mean, there's also the whole Rasta thing about wanting to be black and the return to Africa thing. I don't know if that has anything to do with the way you think about it.
I'd like to revisit Africa before I leave this lifetime. I'd like to. But I don't think it has the same meaning for me. My ancestors weren't sold into slavery. So being a quote-unquote white Rasta and being a black Rasta is very different. Many Rastas have suffered much oppression and tribulation that I haven't suffered, so I'm very aware of that as well.
So how do you see that people look at you? I mean, you know, do they accept, does the art community accept you completely here and in the U.S.? Does the Rasta community accept you? To me, you're really unusual, but maybe it's not so unusual. To be you, to be like you, you know?
Well, there are other people of my complexion in Jamaica with dreadlocks who are Rastas. And artists too, yes. So it's not that unusual. Mm-hmm. This is a very multiracial environment, Jamaica. It's one of the reasons I love it so much.
And you're clearly very, very comfortable here.
Yeah, I used to go back to New York, this was in the early days, and go to shows on 57th Street, and everybody was white, and I didn't love that at all. So I'm much happier in a multiracial.
As an artist, do people question you as being white within the artist community?
You mean the artists here or the artists there?
both either. I mean, I don't know.
I'm showing my work in the cooperative gallery scene in Chelsea, Manhattan. That's not really a place where Rasta is understood. It's not the black community in New York, art community in New York. That's what I wish I was showing more in that community.
Is there a barrier for you there?
Partially, because really a lot of the art, black art scene in New York is they're trying to promote black artists. I understand, you know. I'm not black. I may not be white, but I'm not black either. So my work is not in the right place up there. Mm-hmm. It's being seen, and some people are seeing it that I would love to see it, but it's not quite in its right milieu up there.
And here?
Here, I'm showing at Harmony Hall pretty regularly. Yeah, I've also shown my work in Kingston, in the National Gallery of Art, and they used to have annuals every year, and I've been in many, many annuals, and now since they have biennials, I've been in those too.
Now you're shown in the Jamaican context with other Jamaican artists.
Yes.
In New York.
That's right, it's different.
So if somebody wants to get in touch with you and see your work online, what is the best way to do that?
Well, they can go to my website, which is rastafari-inspiration.com. They can also look up my name, which is R-A-N-I, Ronnie Carson, and that will lead you also to my website, Rastafari Inspiration. Rasta man live up. Bongo man don't give up. Congo man live up.
Known to his friends as Mabrak, Russ Ibrock is an intuitive Jamaican artist living in the same yard as Ronnie Carson. You can see his art on russibrock.wordpress.com. But today I've asked him to talk about Rastafari and his life as a Rastaman. What should we know about Rastafari, I asked Mabrak.
Oh, well, what you should know is that Rastafari, liberty, you know, is to honor the character and the divinity of His Majesty Haile Selassie I first, because the name Rastafari was his name. Mm-hmm. His name was Rastafari Makonnen. Mm-hmm. So that's where the name Rastafari derived from, His Majesty himself. So the liberty is all based on the liberty and the character and the divinity of His Majesty Haile Selassie I.
So how does that then translate into being a Rasta? What do you believe in? What is your philosophy, your practice, your belief?
Again, I said it's all based on living natural, you mm-hmm. know, eating natural, wearing natural, and just a natural liberty, you know, as far away from artificialness and falseness as possible. Babylon is a system that perpetuates falseness and lies and deceit. And Rasta is the opposite of that.
Of Babylon?
Yeah.
Okay, say more about that. Give me some examples.
No, well, you see, the Babylon deceives the people with the kind of food they make and kind of drinks and their concepts and their philosophies. Most of it are deceptive, you know, it's not really... A lot of lies and trickery, you know. The Rasta is there to promote the truth and the rights and justice and equality, you know.
So we all live with Babylon, right? I mean, Babylon is everywhere. Babylon is very strong. So I'm wondering, is that difficult to live apart from Babylon, to live in rejection of Babylon? Is it difficult to have such a life, to be a Rastaman?
No, I wouldn't say it's difficult, but I mean, you got to be conscious in the company you keep, the food you eat, the environment that you're in, and the type of entertainment that you choose for yourself. You know, it's all got to be different, you know?
It's got to be different.
Yeah.
When you say entertainment,
like, in other words, we are in the world but not of the world, because we're all in the world. But if the world is going to north, we should go south. If they are going west, we should go east. Not in the same way, but they are going, you know.
So you don't participate in that life. Is that?
I try not to.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a lot of temptations out there, you know.
Mm.
And some rats get tempted every now and again, you know. The temptation overcomes it. But the mission is to just see His Majesty as an example, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As a true example, and try to walk in His footsteps as much as possible. You know, because He set a good example of how a person can live.
Mm-hmm.
Just to live a simple life. You know, more simple, the better off you might be, you know. Not so much complexity and this and that, you know.
So
simple and natural.
Simple and natural. But,
yeah.
What I was thinking is that sometimes, I mean, I've heard, I think you've told me, other people have told me, sometimes it's difficult to get work because employers may not want to employ people with dreads and, you know, Rasta kind of outlook. Is that so, that it's more difficult to get a job, or is it that you don't even try to do that?
No, it was like that in the earlier, you know, but of late, the system getting more civilized and realize that a person's ability and skill is not measured by your outward appearance. Because if you're a skilled person and your talents are within and your skills are within, and no outward locks or whatever cannot change the inward self, you know. So they're starting to wake up now, you know, and Rastas can get employment in certain places. But the old system of Babylon is to discriminate and fight against us. They want everyone to be like them, to walk in their shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And because Rasta is opposite to them, they're trying to figure out to give us a hard time by not employing us sometime. Because if you're a Babylonian like them, then they quickly hire you and give you a position. But if they find that your outlook is different from them, they give you a harder time, even though sometimes you have a skill. I've seen that, you know.
Does that mean that you become more self-sufficient, more independent?
Yeah. It's all going to be based on self-reliance, you know, because depending on the system is not totally possible and not totally agreeable at each time, because there's no guarantee that they're going to employ you. So the more self-reliant a Rasta can be, the better for him, you know. And we try to promote self-reliance in every aspect, you know. Most Rastas have a skill or a talent, and they try to promote that and for their own support and liberty in Babylon, you know.
I understand now. I would just like you, if you could talk about dreadlocks, what their significance, your dreadlocks, the significance it is to you.
It's the sign of the Nazarite, you know. That's mentioned. If you read Numbers chapter 6 in the Old Testament, it tells you that when the word Nazarite means to separate yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So when a person take a vow of separation, separating themselves from the world, the Nazarite vow tells you that you should let the locks of your head grow, and shouldn't use no scissors or no razor, shouldn't come upon the head, beard, as long as you take that vow of a Nazarite. If you read Numbers chapter 6 in the Old Testament, you'll get more knowledge on that.
I see. So it is rooted in the Old Testament.
Yeah, that's where the locks come from. From the time of your vow, you shouldn't make no razor or no scissors come up on your head, on the corners of your head or your beard.
So for the rest of your life, you will always have dreadlocks, these dreadlocks.
That's the whole liberty where Rasta is concerned, you know.
Mm.
If a person, like, should die suddenly beside you, then you could shave it off, because that person, that dead thing, is unclean, and it will be unclean to you. But usually a true Rasta doesn't go in the presence of a dead, of a dead person. No, you don't go around the dead, because that makes you unclean by going around the dead. That's what Numbers 6 tells you. If you read Numbers chapter 6, it will explain all of that to you.
Okay, because actually what you're saying now reminds me that among the Jews, the Kohanim, who are the Kohens, who are the priestly tribe, they're not allowed to be in a cemetery.
No. Because being close in the presence of, so if I'm around any person, that I don't go and look at them. Because something, when you see a dead person, that image remains in your consciousness for a long, long time. It doesn't come out so easy. Like most of the time you shut your eyes, you see that dead person. You keep seeing it. And that's like a poison to your conscience and makes your conscience impure and unclean. So usually Rasta doesn't go around dead, not even the family. If the family can go to a service, to a Thanksgiving service for a family, but you don't go. You don't have to go to the funeral to look at your mother, your aunt, your sister. It's never usually recommended, you know?
Really? I didn't
know
that.
Some Rasta might do it, but, you know, I don't do those things, and most Rasta don't do those kind of things.
Because you don't want to have the images in your mind as well.
You're right. It's going to leave an image in your mind, and that's no good for you.
So talk about then another misconception, I think, is you're going to tell me, is about ganja, that it's a drug.
Yeah, and I'm not going to say, and I'm saying ganja would never be a drug. A drug is usually a man-made thing, something that man combines more than one compounds or elements together to make a drug. Mm-hmm. And something that goes naturally out of the earth, you know, like a plant, could never be a drug, you know. Same way like the corn, the gungo peas, and the pear and tomato and all those stuff. Those go naturally out of the earth. So if you're going to put one, say one's a drug, might as well say all of them is a drug.
So you think of, you call it a herb, right?
Of course it is an herb. It is an herb, not a drug. But it is a concept of Babylon, because a person might smoke it and get high, and they might hallucinate a little bit. They want to say it's a drug, you know, but it's not a drug. That's their misconception of saying it's a drug. That's their misconception.
You've cast a lot of light now, for me anyway, about Rastafari. But before we end, what would you like to say in ending, you know, for other people to know that they don't know, or that you would like them to know about Rastafari, just as an ending comment?
That they should remember that it's two worlds, the spiritual world and the physical world, and they should try and spend some time to discover their inner self. And Rastafari gives a person an opportunity to seek within and try to discover your inner self. Because well, the Satan man Christ has said, greater is he that dwelleth within you than he that dwelleth in the world. But the world we live in puts a lot of emphasis just on the physical, material world. And just disregard the spiritual world. And say you're mad or you're crazy once you mention anything that's spiritual. Rasta is here to remind you that there is indeed a spiritual world. And people can try and seek it out and discover it for themselves.
One love. What about the one heart? What about the let's get together and feel alright?
From their yard in Jamaica, you heard Rani Carson talk about her art, after which Russ Ibrock talked about Rastafari. Tidings from Hazel Khan is produced by Tony Ernst. Tidings programs are archived at hazelkhan.com.
Give thanks and praise to the Lord, and I will feel